Are you ready?
Let's do it.
I'm ready, baby. Knife Talk is sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturer of the finest knife heat treat ovens available. Find your next heat treat oven at evenheat-kiln.com. Welcome to Knife Talk. I'm your guest host, Jeff Fader of Fader Knives. Today's show is very special. I'll be talking to Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives. What's going on, Craig?
It's all good. This is so weird. This is so weird. You doing intros.
Well, you know, that's what you get with me. Poor shit. So what are you up to these days?
Well, just very busy. So, yeah, I've got a bit of a change coming up with regards to my circumstances. And yeah, we'll talk about that a bit later. But, yeah, I've been traveling a lot, making lots of prototypes. Just really busy.
Well,
good.
One thing that's interesting about you, Craig, is that your knives are you know, generally speaking, culinary knives. So
yes, yeah.
Tell me how you kind of got started doing knives. I know that you weren't a metal worker to begin with. What's your story?
It's a bit of a strange one, different to most people. But, you know, up until about 4 years ago, when I started making knives about 4 years ago, I'd always been a web designer. So, you know, for, you know, 20-odd years.
Right.
I'm old. I'm really old.
You're not that old.
But if you do a job for over 20 years, you sort of become part of a community then, you know?
Right.
You know, and I love being part of a community. I love the support. I love the shared knowledge that a community brings and all that kind of stuff. So I started putting on various events and so on for designers, you know, starting with little conferences, you know, maybe sort of 200 people, growing to, you know, a few conferences a year with, you know, up to 1,200 people. You know, they're quite big events. People from all over the world would come, that kind of thing.
Wow.
I also set up like a co-working studio right in the middle of my home city, which is Cardiff, so people could come and work and collaborate, you know, teach and learn from each other. That also then turned into sort of a publishing company. So we're publishing design books from sort of high-end, you know, high-profile designers, which meant over time I was doing, you know, more and more admin and less creating. I wasn't really making stuff, you know, just firefighting, admin, that kind of thing. And to be honest, I wasn't really earning much money. I
right.
was doing lots for the community, but, you know, struggling to make ends meet, really.
Right. So what made you start to, like, get making things, like physically?
Well,
with your hands?
It's coming.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, it wasn't healthy for me. I think that's the main thing. You know, spending 14 hours in front of a screen 7 days a week, you know, it's probably not healthy for anybody. So I decided to do just one more event, which was a little different. So we hired a sort of retreat kind of venue, and, you know, surrounded by acres and acres of woodland. And I put on what I was calling a summer camp for designers.
Wow.
So instead of the usual high-profile designers come in and, you know, speaking in a stuffy theatre, which was, you know, what I'd done for years before that, it was outdoors. And, you know, attendees, we'd come, we'd do workshops, we did, you know, screen printing, we did, you know, a making bread, we did a making beer workshop, just all hands-on stuff. But the favourite one was, you know, we all walked into the woods, we cut down a tree, and we all just carved spoons. It was like a, you know, spoon-carving workshop.
Huh.
And I loved it, you know. I thought, this is what I've been missing. I haven't made anything for so long. So going back then to the city centre office, you know, there's not really much scope for wood, you know,
yeah.
for carving wooden spoons, you know. So I started making stuff with what I knew, which was code, you know. So I'm making, you know, way before all these, you know, these Internet of Thing devices now, as they're called, you know, that turn on your lights from your phone and turn on your heat and that kind of thing. I was making these kind of things with little Arduinos and Raspberry Pis, that kind of thing. But obviously, to be a product, they needed some sort of housing, you know, some sort
right.
of, you know, something to put in to make it into a real thing. So, you know, you jump on YouTube and I'm looking at people, you know, vacuum forming plastics and making these intricate boxes and so on. And you know what it's like. You go down that YouTube rabbit hole, you know, where, you know, 6 hours later, you're still looking at people making these crazy things.
Yeah.
And I came across a video. I can't remember now, but I think it was probably a Walter Sorrells video, making a knife. So I was like, hey, I'm gonna try making a knife. Made a knife, and that was it. Had the bug, the sickness, you know?
Well, you didn't have any experience with metalworking in general before you did that.
None at all. So, you know, in school we did, you know, we made a bottle opener, that kind of thing, you know, but that
right.
was, you know, 25 years before this, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So it was quite a strange thing. So, you know, I was still running a design business, you know, and a co-working studio and an events business and a publishing business. And, you know, I was making knives too on the side, which, you know, just for family and friends at that point.
Right.
But eventually, you know, I knew things had to change. I was, you know, I was working all these hours that, you know, God gave us. Didn't really enjoy it. You know, I wasn't really making any money. Health wasn't good. Stress levels were off the charts. And, you know, and my wife, who was my business partner, she's the smartest person I know. And, you know, and I knew this was just holding her back. These businesses, they weren't my dream, and they certainly weren't hers. So we decided to change everything. We shut the businesses down. We sold virtually all of our possessions. We jumped in a car and we drove to France, and we decided to spend 2 weeks just looking for a house. And then we were going to start our new dream. So for my wife, which was to start her new business, which is sort of adult education, that kind of thing. And for me, just to be making knives. So that was just over 2.5 years ago. And we haven't looked back since.
Wow. So you sold everything and you drove to France?
We
what
did.
What possessed you to go to France?
Well, you know, better climate than the UK. Not too far. So we could still get back and see family and friends. But, you know, cheap to live. The sun always shines. It was, you know, it made sense for us. And people thought we were crazy. You know, we had these businesses. And
I think you're crazy.
But everybody thought we were doing really well. But, you know, we weren't. We were just working all the hours. And, you know, it was just stressful. It wasn't good. And, you know, we weren't doing what we loved doing. So, yeah, we just hopped in a car and started a new life.
Wow. So just to just jump back just a little bit. So you watched the Walter Soros video. Maybe you watched a couple of other you know, YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And then you just called up and bought some steel. And how did you how did you do it all? You had minimal tools.
Yeah, well, very minimal. So I bought one of those, you know, those 1x30 little bandsaws, you know, grinders.
Right.
Terrible things, but, you know, they did the job. I got a little devil forge, a little gas devil forge, which is, you know, only sort of 6 inches deep. It's a tiny thing.
Right.
And, you know, these first knives, they were terrible, as you'd imagine.
They're supposed to be terrible.
Yeah.
The first ones are supposed to be terrible.
Well, it's not just the first one. I'd say for the first year, everyone was terrible.
The first 30 have to be garbage.
Yeah.
And that's the only way you can't really learn unless you actually kind of say, all right, next time I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
So that's how you get to that point. So that's quite an investment from one Walter Soros video.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was that thing you just said about that first one, you know, it's terrible. The next 30 are terrible. But, you know, I'd probably spend a year and I'd probably make a knife every day for that time. And every time I made a knife, it was like, oh, man, I just want to sort of recall all those old ones, you know.
Right.
And, you know, when I was making stuff with code, I could do that. I could just, you know, update all the code. Everybody's got the newest version. And it was just so frustrating that, you know, everyone was getting so much better, which is great. But then you've got these knives out there that you're just not happy with. So,
but those are also milestones in your life.
They are.
And I think that it's very important to see growth in regards to whatever you're doing. So, you know, if you're ever really truly satisfied with anything that you do, you're probably not really seeing what's really going on. So when I understand what you're saying, because I look at knives that I made and I say the same thing. I'm like, the next one's gonna be better. But you can't really go back. You gotta like just look forward and know that the next one's gonna be better. But other than that, I'm riveted by your story. So now you're in France.
Yep.
And now you're in France, and now you bought a house. You and your wife's teaching adult education, and then you're building up your shop.
Yeah. Still building the shop. Still building it. It's ongoing. But I did that thing that a lot of people do where you make maybe your first sort of 30, 50 knives and you think, right, I'm an acceptable standard now, you know? So I get a website up and I start selling to the public. And 2 months later, you know, I'm discovering all these great knife makers on Instagram and Facebook and so on.
Yeah.
And you just think, man, I'm just, you know, they're in a different league. So what I did, so when I just mentioned, you know, you wish you could call them all back, you know. So I stopped. I took the website down. This was probably about 18 months ago. I took the website down for 4 months, and I literally just spent every working hour in the workshop just nailing these knives, just, you know, knife after knife after knife.
Right.
And, you know, I wasn't selling these. It was a very conscious decision that, you know, I've got a drawer back in the workshop with probably about 150 knives in there, you know? But each one was getting better and better and better. And it was only to that point where, you know, those gains started reducing. So, you know, I was happy with every knife, you know? I sort of come to a happy medium. And that's when, you know, made a new website, start putting them up and started selling knives again. But I see that a lot. I see a lot of people making knives and, you know, they make, you know, 3-4 knives. Then next, you know, they're selling their knives and you just think, wow, I made that mistake too, you know?
Well, you know, that's very funny that you say that, because I actually wanted to talk about, you know, in regards to, you know, when people first starting out making knives and different experiences and different things that your experiences are different than other people's experiences. And my experience is, I started out as a sculptor and then I ended up working for a blacksmithing company. And I was actually I wasn't making knives until, you know, 10 years since I started blacksmithing. You know, I hadn't even touched a knife until I was forging railings and tools and stuff like that. But I'd never forged a knife until years and years later. And it's interesting because my experience is different than your experience, which is different than a lot of your listeners' experience. And I think that all these different experiences are good. And being able to watch YouTube videos are good. And to be able to learn and just say to yourself, you got to do whatever it takes. Some people don't have access to certain equipment. Some people don't have access to certain techniques. And YouTube has become a resource that allows people to say, hey, you know what? I can make this. And maybe if somebody wants it, that's great. I think that it's really important. And I also, back to what you were saying in regards to, you saw these knife makers that made you think that your knives didn't look good. There are levels to this game. And as a knife maker or whatever, there really needs to be this, you know, appreciation of growth and figuring out, I got to do whatever it takes. You know, I live in an apartment. I can't have an anvil, you know, or I can't, you know, I want to make Damascus, but I don't have a power hammer. You know, there's levels to this game, and I think that it's very important to just kind of celebrate that growth and be supportive of, you know, people trying to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah, oh, completely. And I have to say, if it wasn't for YouTube and seeing that first, I'm pretty sure it was a Walter Sorrells video. Yeah. That, you know, I would never have made that first knife. You know,
sure.
And you know,
no, it's exciting.
Completely, it's a new world. You know, and you're excited, and you know. You just want to be making knives all the time, and you have this big sort of equipment list of stuff that you think you desperately need, and it's this whole new world opened up.
Yeah, it's incredible. So now, what's your next step?
Next step? Wow. Okay. Personally, I've been finding it very hard to live in, you know, a very remote area of France. I'm not in a city anymore, so it's very hard to sort of sell what I make. So quite often I'll go, you know, I'll take a flight or whatever to a big city, and I'll go around and I'll meet restaurants and I'll meet chefs. And, you know, we get commissions that way, and I start making knives, that kind of thing, which is great. You know, and I've been really fortunate enough to speak with, you know, lots of amazing knife makers on the show. And I often ask that very same question, like, how do you scale things up? You know, so running a business and chasing the dream of making knives every day, they're very different things, I think. And I've been giving this loads of thought over the last year or so. So I want to make a product. I want Chop Knives to be a product business, you know? So something that can be packaged up and maybe even sold in a store. But a product that's handmade but still affordable. So something that's going to be the same each time. Not exactly the same, obviously, because you'll be using slightly different materials for handles and so on. But the blade is, you know, the blade's going to be the same each time. So I'm going to start with a steak knife. You know, in my mind, what I think is the perfect steak knife. So for the past 6 months, I've been working on dozens of prototypes, which I've been, you know, making and taking to various restaurants to speak with the proprietors and chefs and so on for their opinion. And I want to make a knife that, you know, it's close to as perfect as you can get. And, you know, I think I've got there. So I've got a design which is beautiful to look at. It's razor sharp. You know, it cuts like butter. It's lovely. But as we all know, a handmade knife takes a lot of time. And this can make them, you know, too pricey for most people. So that's the challenge, you know, making something that's handmade, beautiful, does its job perfectly. but still affordable to most people.
Right.
So I've been visiting factories over Europe for the last few weeks to talk to them about my plans and, you know, take as many tips as I can from them of how they set up their sort of production lines. So I think I've got a solution. I'm going to produce these knives by buying steel in bulk straight from Sandvik. So I use a 14C28N stainless. I get the steel cut to profile with water jets. And I know a lot of people may think, well, you're not making a knife. But, you know, this is a blank. This is, you know, it has no bevels. It's literally just cut to shape. And that's the bit for me that takes the most amount of time, you know, to get things precise every time. That takes a lot of time. Not too much skill, strangely. It's just time.
It's time.
Yeah, so I cut down that time to manufacture massively, you know. So I still hand grind the bevels, I still stabilize my own wood, still make my own mosaic pins. Now, you know, I do all the heat treating in-house, but all of those actions can be done sort of in bulk, really, you know.
Right.
So I've even remodeled my studio to accommodate for sort of a factory-like production line. So each knife is then going to get the attention it needs, you know, for the final fit-up. And I think this is the kind of thing that a big factory can't really do. Because, you know, maybe they're using robots or whatever they're using. But I'm using natural materials, particularly for handles and so on. You know, and they're never uniform. So, you know, by doing this by hand, I can make sure that every single knife then is, you know, it's perfect, it feels good in the hand, and it's, you know, it's sharp as a razor. They're all hand sharpened too. So today, I've launched an Indiegogo campaign where people can order a knife or a set of steak knives, and that's going to really sort of kickstart the production.
Wow.
So that's what I've been working on.
So they're pre-ordering. People will be pre-ordering your knives.
Well, I'm ready to go. So the last 6 months, this is what I've been doing. So I've been taking very few sort of customer orders. The workshop has been completely remodeled so I can just work on batches after batches after batches. So in essence, yeah, I suppose it's pre-ordering.
That's it. Oh my God. It's unbelievable.
We mentioned scaling things up, right? So, you know, as you know, a handmade knife, you know, even if it has been profiled by a water jet, it still takes a lot of time.
Yeah,
you know, particularly if you're aiming for the, you know, the kind of quality which I'm aiming for. So I think I can produce maybe a dozen to 15 knives on my own per week. You know, which is fine.
That's fair.
But it's not, you know, it's not production line, you know?
Right.
But my little tiny village here in France, it's got one of the oldest forges in Europe. But it's no longer a forge, it's a museum. You know, still has a forge, it's set up as a forge, but it's now just a museum. But what it does mean is that I'm surrounded by lots of fourth or fifth generation knife makers, you know?
Right.
And they've all now turned their hand to farming. They're struggling, you know, the demands of, you know, mass production in the farming world, it's very hard on a small farm. So if I need to produce more than a dozen or 15 knives per week, which I'm hoping is the case, you know, I've got skilled knife makers on tap, you know, and who knows, maybe I can get, you know, my little town making knives again. You know, that would be something worth working
for. This is like a movie. This is like one of those Irish movies where you bring the factory back. And
but it's happened in lots of villages around France, you know. And the French have got a rich history. So, you know, La Guillon knives, that's a very small village in France. You know, Thiers, you know, very similar there. Openel isn't the village, but the actual village, you know, it's all the local people making knives there. So it's happened before in France, and I've got big ideas.
So that's incredible. I love the whole story, and I love the idea of what you're doing. And I wonder. I'm just asking, just curious, but just because I don't know. I know a little bit about Kickstarter, and I know about so for the Indiegogo. Do you have a set goal that you need to make in order for this to happen, or
it's slightly different with Indiegogo to Kickstarter? So. With Kickstarter, you say, let's say I need 10 grand for this to happen.
Right.
If you don't get backing up to 10 grand, it doesn't happen. Simply, you don't get any money and nobody gets any of the rewards, you know? But with Indiegogo, it's slightly different. So let's say I say, well, actually, it's 7.5 grand. That's what I'm saying in euros that I need for this to happen. But if it doesn't happen...
It's not a lot of money.
It's not a lot of money. But if this doesn't happen, people will still get those rewards because then I can just simply hand grind them anyway.
Right,
you know?
Right. Okay, great.
Because
right,
if it doesn't,
so if you're putting in for some steak knives, you're getting them.
Yeah, and the thing is, if it doesn't happen, that's because I haven't got to the volume that I require. So if it's not getting to that volume where I need to produce these in that way, I can just produce them how I've normally made knives anyway. So it's right. a win-win, you know? It just works either way.
Wow, I like this idea. I like this idea very much. You know, my business model is similar in the sense that we do a lot of pre-ordering. So I don't use Indiegogo, but like when we do Chef Series knives, if I do a series of 12, we pre-sell them before I make them.
Yeah.
And usually I'll start making them once we've sold four. Like if we can sell four of them, then I'll start to make them. And then, you know, that'll make my life a lot easier because then no one's kind of dumping money down.
Exactly.
To get these rolling, and then they're guaranteed for the thing. Well, I think it's great, and I heard a little something in your voice when you were talking about the handmade thing, and it's there. Like I was saying before, there are levels to this game.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to do whatever it takes. And I once had an old knife maker come into my shop, and I was grinding a bevel, and I had the table on the platen on the grinder. And I actually had clamped my knife to a very square 2x4. And then I was using that 2x4 as my guide just to keep myself at the same level when I was grinding. The first thing the guy said is, "Oh, you're cheating." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "Oh, you should be doing it freehand." And I was just like, you need to leave. This is, you know, you have to do whatever it takes. Efficiency and taking some little steps out of this process allows you to kind of focus on the things that really matter. And part of that mattering is being able to provide something for people at a reasonable price and to have your sincerity involved.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I asked that question on Instagram. I did an Instagram story, when is a knife handmade? And I said, if it's been profiled on a water jet, is it still handmade? And it was amazing, actually. So I'd say probably 95% said yes.
Yes, it is handmade.
Yeah, yeah. But those who didn't, they were sending me a message as to say why they think it isn't. And they were all very, very sort of valid reasons. But, you know, how far do you go to handmade? You know, are you sort of smelting your own steels? You know,
well,
where does that go, you know?
Well, that's the next thing because, you know, that's interesting that you say that too because – recently, I was making some integral knives. I was forging some integral knives, and I posted a picture of me forging the integral knives. And somebody had responded with, "It's great to see somebody actually forging their knives like they used to," because and I'm paraphrasing. I don't really remember exactly, because now people just grind knives out of they just take a piece of steel and they grind knives out of it.
Yeah.
And what I had said, and that's an old, you know, that's actually the elephant in the room in regards to a lot of knife makers and bladesmiths, and whether you're calling yourself a knife maker or a bladesmith, is this concept of stock removal versus forging. And a lot of people, this guy had basically said, yeah, forged knives are where it's at. And I said to him very, with peace and love, there's nothing wrong with stock removal knives. Some of the best knife makers in the world make stock removal knives. And I'm not going to name them out, but you'd be shocked. And there's nothing wrong with it. So you get to the point where you're asking, what's the difference? What's the gain? And in regards to being able to provide something for a customer that's of a high quality, steel, Bob Kramer gets a triple beam balance to make his steel, and he uses powder, and as you were saying, he smelts it down in an induction furnace. There are certain levels that you just can't do, and if you're able to do stock removal because what you're trying to provide is something affordable, if you're trying to do stock removal because you feel like you will get a better product, like say with stainless steel, sometimes you're going to get it for, if you have to make a 9-inch chef knife with a 2-inch heel, you really got to work like a dog to forge a knife that long, especially if it's stainless steel, it's a whole production too. So where are your gains and where are your losses, and how can you be as efficient as possible and provide a product to someone who wants to buy your knife, a friend of yours, a family member, whatever, and not say, "I want to buy your knife, but I don't have $3,000. You know, that's the issue.
There's levels of consumer, right? So you've got,
right.
You've got the 40 grand Bob Kramer knives. You've got the, you know, a couple of grand, you know, if you look, I think it's theforge.com where they take people's knives, you know, very high end knives, and they sell them. I think they're based in Dubai. But they're, you know, they're sort of 2-4 grand knives. You know, you've got the sort of high end store knives, which may be, you know, sort of $300-$400 or whatever.
Right.
And then you've got, you know, you've got the shit, you've got the you know, right, the Chinese press stuff, you know? Right. So there's levels of consumer. And I think as long as you're being completely honest with the consumer, they know exactly what's what.
Exactly. That's the most important thing. It doesn't really matter what your level is as a blacksmith or a bladesmith or whatever. It's the concept of being, you know, genuine and sincere and giving someone, you know, your, what you believe in it, and you want them to believe in you.
Yeah, completely.
So I, you know, it's funny. It's really funny because, you know, I was, I've been really fortunate lately. I've been befriending a lot of awesome bladesmiths and knife makers, and I talked to a lot of them. And recently I was actually at Dragon's Breath Forge.
I did see. Yes. Yeah.
I was with Matt Parkinson and Mareko Momasi, and those two motherfuckers are unbelievable. But the amazing thing is, as soon as I walked in the door, Matt was standing by a forge. He was literally forging a sword. It was a long sword. And we started talking, and I'm going to do a project with him, and I'm doing a project with Mareko, and I'm really excited, a illustration drawing. And what we were talking about, I don't remember what we were talking, but we were talking about why he loves to forge. And Matt said, I don't like to grind, and this is fun. You know, that's what a lot of it comes down to, that this concept of, you know, some people, I've heard people say they love grinding, or I have friends who say, I love to forge. And there's different reasons why you do certain things. There's some people like certain aspects of it, and other people don't. And they're trying to, like, give you something from their heart, from what they love to do. The reason why they love to do what they do is because they do it well, and then they're gaining proficiency in it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the reason I'm not forging knives is because, first of all, I don't have the resource.
Right.
But most importantly, I don't have the skill. It's hugely skilled, you know? So, well, you know, for me to do that, it's investing, you know, a lot of time.
Well, look, please, I'm with you.
And
this is something, and I'm sorry for jumping in on you, interrupting. But what I try to tell people is, and something I get so many emails from friends of mine who say to me, I see what's going on with the forging. I want to make Damascus. Where do I buy an anvil? And the first thing I always say is, don't buy anything. And I say, go take a class. Because there's this whole concept of, one of the great things about YouTube is there's so many resources, but there also is something that I refer to as YouTube confidence. Mm-hmm. And basically, when you know, if you watch somebody grind a bevel on YouTube, and you get a grinder, and you get a couple pieces of steel, you can kind of figure it out. There's not a whole lot to it. But what forging is, forging anything, doesn't really matter if it's a knife or anything, is it's the finesse and the confidence, and also the manipulation of material in a specific way, in a specific set. So you have certain steps that you have to do, and some of those things are not very easy to just explain. So you actually have to physically do them, and you have to have a mindset of, I have to get from A to Z, but I need to go through the entire alphabet to get there. And if you skip F and B, your whole thing is a disaster. So it can take years and years and years to understand and get the feeling of how a hammer should feel when you hit a piece of material, how hot a piece of steel needs to be to get in that plastic stage where you can actually move it like plastic. And it's one of those things that a lot of people watch videos, or they see things and they say, or knife makers will say, I'm going to make Damascus. So they think, all right, well, I'm going to forge. All I have to do is learn how to forge well this Damascus. So let me go buy an anvil. I'll buy a hammer. And then all of a sudden you don't realize, well, that's your forge might not be able to get your Damascus at forge welding temperature. And then how in the God's name are you going to set the weld of a 6-inch billet that you can't possibly forge down to what you think you're going to do?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you've spent all this money, and now you're saying, why is this rock hammer not forging this material the way I want? And then you got, and then someone's like, Well, because, asshole, that's a fucking rock hammer. You're supposed to use a forging hammer. And what's the difference between peens? And what's the difference between a rounding hammer? There's so much information involved. And yeah, a lot of knife makers. And this is a very interesting thing because I love Nick Rossi from New England School of Metalwork.
Ooh, the Nick Wheeler alarm nearly went off then. I thought we were going to have
the
Nick Wheeler
don't
word.
Worry. Don't worry. Don't, just turn the alarm off now and then I'll get to the I'll hit the alarm a few more times. So Nick Rossi gives a lot of information out. He does a lot of videos. He does incredible amount of teaching of how to forge knives. He forges all sorts of folding knives. He forges chef knives, hunting knives. He's incredible, incredible teacher. And the one person I really want to get class from bad is Nick Rossi. So he has a video out there where he's forging out an integral knife. And I'm watching it, and I'm watching it, and I'm watching it, and I'm watching it. And I've forged before. And I think to myself, okay, great. I'm going to get myself a piece of 1-inch 1084, and I'm going to hand hammer it the way he does. That is a long day in the office, my buddy, because you can't do it. It's very similar to when you watch a marathon and you say to yourself, if you've never run before, I'm going to get a pair of sneakers and I'm going to run the next marathon I can get myself into. And then all of a sudden you get your sneakers on and then you're going out for a run. And after a mile, you're like, how am I going to make it to 24 miles? It's impossible. You know, there are also with YouTube confidences, there's this, you need to manage your expectations. And the best thing I can tell people, and I tell great bladesmiths, I tell great knife makers who make beautiful knives, don't buy anything. Go take a class. And the funny thing is a lot of blacksmithing schools like the Center for Metal Arts, like New England School of Metalwork, they teach introductory classes. And a lot of people are like, well, I don't want to take an introductory class. I want to make knives. The reason
I've seen
why,
videos, I know how it's done. I'll skip that.
Yeah,
step. Yeah.
it's like unbelievable. And I'm also of the mind of in my experience, I don't really want to take introductory class either. But the problem is forging isn't just making a point and forging out a bevel. You're manipulating mass. You're figuring out exact dimensions because you're holding your metal towards it at an anvil at a specific angle. You're taking your anvil and you're using different corners, different parts. It's a production. And if you don't understand the basics of it, there's no way you're going to start making integral knives. That's it. Period. Yeah.
I think what you said, YouTube confidence, is another one. So, you know, I fell for that. I saw a video that I can do that. What you don't see, I mean, let's take, for example, Alex Steele. So incredible. Right. What he does is incredible. So he's just done a series on making a rapier. And I think it was like 15 videos, and each one's maybe 15 minutes each, you know?
Right.
And this guy works. This guy works 14 hours a day, I think every day of the week. You know, and he's editing this down to 15 minutes. And you think, right, I can see what he's done. He's got that tool. He's done that. He's got that tool. Right. He's done that. What you don't see is that sort of 10,000, 15,000 hours experience that he's had, you know? You can
get the
tools, but you need experience to know what you're doing with those things. And I did it the wrong way. I bought the tools, all the gear, no idea. And, I had to make those mistakes to learn that lesson. So,
well,
yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, but that's the thing. You can't just expect it to come easy. But you can do it. You can buy an anvil. You can buy an anvil, and then you can hit it once, and then your neighbors are like, what is going on? You know? I have a joke with my buddy Sunset Forge, New Jersey. Sunset Forge NJ. That's John Arion. Mm-hmm. He makes the best press. He and Cliff Dufton make the best hydraulic presses in the world. Go see their presses. We refer to some anvils. I have a Fisher anvil. It was my first anvil. And then I have a Hey Budden anvil that I got from Jesse Savage. The Fisher has a very light, is a very muffled sound. And the Hey Budden, which is a Hey Budden, sorry, whatever the pronunciation is, it has a very ringing sound. So the joke is there's a city anvil, which is the quieter one, and there's a country anvil, which has the louder ring. So, you know, there are times where if you have a garage and you have close neighbors and you hit that anvil, they're coming out on the fifth hit. I'm telling you. It's so loud.
Yeah. You know, I was watching – so I've been watching a lot of videos on, water pressure jets, that kind of thing, you know, to cut things out.
Sure.
And there's these guys – I can't think – I'm trying to look them up now. I can't find them. But they basically they've got this water jet, and they just cut things in half. It can be anything, you know. And
they do
these crazy science videos. But they do one with an anvil, and they get this cheap Chinese anvil, and they cut it in half. And it, man, I think it was cast iron, and it's just full of voids. There's holes in there big enough for a tennis ball, you know? It was crazy to see.
Well, that's another story in regards to anvils. And I actually, before I talk to you, I sent a message to my friend Jesse Savage, who is the premier anvil enthusiast in the Northeast of the United States. No question. Nobody knows more about anvils than Jesse Savage. Great guy, awesome blacksmith. He just taught a class down at the CMA. Bottle opener class. And I asked him, because I knew I was going to get on this conversation with you. I said, we're people who want to buy anvils. And I get a lot of questions about what kind of anvil should I buy? Where should I buy it? I wanted to know what the best resource is for people in buying anvils. And what he said, which I kind of thought was correct, was you need to have a feeling and understanding of what you're trying to get. You have to have a knowledge of the kind of anvil you want. And then you have to just scour eBay and Craigslist. That's what he does, because he buys anvils and he sells anvils. And don't ask him to sell you an anvil, because he'll have some sort of stroke or panic attack over in Rutland, Vermont. But he actually bought an anvil from him. He's very. This is a big secret I just gave up, but it's fine. So a lot of anvils are made differently. A lot of anvils are forged welded together. There'll be like a piece of tool steel will be the first half inch of the face of the knife of the anvil, and then the rest might be, it's a softer steel. That's part of blacksmithing too, is the economy of materials. That's the reason why you don't see with Damascus knives, you don't see a whole lot of knife makers making full tang Damascus knives. Because the material is so hard to make and it's so expensive to make, why would you just put 5 inches of your Damascus inside of a handle where you could just forge it into a stick tang or hidden tang, and then you're only losing like maybe 2 inches of the material? So the anvils are the same way. So a lot of times you won't know what an anvil is. You can get an idea when you hit it, or you can get an idea based on the rebound. That means, how the hammer comes off the anvil. But a lot of times you go to Harbor Freight, or you go to all these guys who sell these cheap. If you see a cheap anvil, you either can get someone who has no idea what it is, and you might get lucky, or you're getting garbage. You got to be very, 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 very understanding of what you're looking for, because, like I said, the best way to get involved with bladesmithing or blacksmithing is to take a class, because you all of a sudden, you have instructors who are watching you hit. Like, I've forged with guys who don't have a whole lot of experience, and I've seen them swing their hammer, and all of a sudden in my mind, all I can think of is that dude's going to be so sore tomorrow, he's not going to lift his arm up. It's just the positioning, how you stand, how you should stand, what position you should be in, what's the most ergonomic way to forge. How can you do this so you can do this for days on end, weeks on end, months on end?
And it's taking advantage of their experience, isn't it? They've got the experience, so take it from them.
It's like if you go to a gym and you just start lifting weights like a mental patient without having any information. If you get the goddamn trainer right off the bat, he's going to tell you what you're doing right or doing wrong. When I was working I was at the Center for Metal Arts before Pat Quinn took it over and turned it into just like a what he did at the Center for Metal Arts is unbelievable. When I was there, we were doing mostly railings. I was working under John Ledford, and we were doing more structural work, ornamental iron work, than we were doing classes. So we were like, it was fine architecture, metalsmiths was doing whatever. So it got to the point, especially in the summer, where you really had to treat yourself like an athlete, as in you got to get enough sleep. If you come in hungover, they're going to fuck you up, because they're going to make you forge all day and then you're going to throw up. Or you have to be able to eat correctly. You have to be able to be hydrated. You have to really, because the intensity of the heat, and also you can't do a marathon and sprint the whole time. You got to pace yourself. And if you have to forge for weeks on, and there were railings, I'd have to forge 1,000, 2,000 pickets. It takes a long time, and you have to get in a rhythm, and you have to get a pattern, and you have to say to yourself, okay, I need to be able to make this amount of forging for this long. And then all of a sudden, if your arm starts to hurt, what are you going to do? You're going to go to your boss, and you're going to say, I got to take the day off because my arm hurts? No, you have to figure out a way to make sure that you as a cog in the machine can keep the machine rolling. And as a knife maker, as a blacksmith, as a bladesmith, it's the same thing. So you have to take these things. It's like that whole marathon thing. Don't buy the sneakers. Don't buy the sneakers. Take your sneakers you have and go for a walk. And then all of a sudden, and then, all right, let's do a mile. All right, let's do 2 miles. Let's do 3 miles. Don't buy the sneakers and try to fucking run 20 miles. It's impossible. You can't do it. Same thing with blacksmithing. Don't buy the anvil. Just go take some classes. Trust me, you're going to save money and time and energy. And it might not be for you. Hmm. You might spend, you know, a good 200-pound anvil can – I mean, the prices are changed all the time. And in the United States, you know, these sons of bitches at the antique stores realize what they have, but they have no concept of what the face should look like. If a face is too chippy, if the corners are too rounded, if it's got too much sway in the face, if the horn's broken off, they don't realize. They just see money. You have to understand that you have to kind of understand what's correct, what's not correct, because you're going to get ripped off. And if you get one of these Harbor Freight cast iron anvils, you're doing yourself a disservice. And all of a sudden, you're going to hate working. You're going to be hate. You're going to say, "Oh God, I spent $1,000 on all this equipment, and now I don't even want to do it."
Mm, yeah. Yeah, it's like people, you know, learning guitar. They go out and buy the cheapest guitar right. They can get, and it rips their fingers to shreds. You know,
right?
And well, it's like, yeah, get a half decent guitar, and you'll be able to live with it. Yeah,
right. But with a guitar, you can't make knives. You know, you can play with your friends, but you can't, and you don't get dirty with a guitar.
True.
Don't know.
Very true.
But I bet
somebody has made Damascus out of guitar strings.
Most likely, I mean, they do out of chainsaw belts, motorcycle belts. And, I mean, that's another thing. You know, Damascus is – and just getting back to kind of stock removal versus bladesmiths, I know really great bladesmiths who make Damascus billets. They have a power hammer or they have a press, or maybe they'll have a friend who has a power hammer and a press, and they'll maybe rent space for a week and they'll just make Damascus all week. And then they'll make the billets – the length and the width of their knives, and then they'll stock removal the knives. I took a class with Aaron Wilburn at Wilburn Forge, and it was at the Center for Metal Arts, and he was awesome. I love that guy. My Mount Rushmore is getting bigger and bigger. when we made billets, what I was amazed at is I just did whatever he said. I wasn't like preconceived notions. I just wanted to go with the flow. So we made this billet. It was a long billet. And then he wanted us to twist them. So we twisted them and turned the billet into a twist bar. Then we forged down the twist bar back into a billet. And we made Crush W Theory Damascus. So I think to myself, okay, great. I'm going to be able to, you know, take this home. The material is like 3/8 thick. It's about 2 inches. I'll be able to make some chef knives. And he said, well, don't forget, you're going to have to cut away a lot of material because where the twists were, the twists didn't forge well. So you have about a quarter of an inch on each side that you're going to have to knock off. So now all of a sudden you have an inch and a half piece of bar. And I said, I'll take a pair of that and then I can just forge it down. He goes, oh, no, don't do that because you're going to ruin the pattern. What you should do is you should anneal the whole thing and then stock removal the knife. And that's what I did. And that isn't cheating. You know, we all can't be Nick Anger, who makes these incredible knives of just, you know, that the whole pattern flows out of the blade. Sometimes you have to do whatever it takes to kind of like get to the point where you want to without people saying, you know, oh, using a power hammer, that's cheating. Are you insane? Totally insane.
And you got to look at the performance of the knife too, you know? You know, nobody's really going to know the difference when they're using the knife, whether it's forged or whether it's stock removal.
That's
you know,
right.
If it cuts, if it's got, you know, a good geometry and it's sharp, that's what you're looking for.
That goes into it, as you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I recently had a guy email me and he said to me, are your knives fully forged? And
just the handles.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was this question, and a lot of it, and I'm sure that custom knife makers get this a lot. You know, people are trying to customers are very important. Yeah. And one thing is you have to let them relate to you, but you have to also speak plainly with them. Don't, you know, there's no it's not necessary for anybody to have to use big words. I'm a broad strokes guy. I say that all the time. I give you the broad strokes, and I want to speak plainly because I'm a very simple person, believe it or not. I'm a dull moron. I'm just human garbage. So
are you doing this thing where you want me to big you up now? Is that
no,
what
I don't
this
want
is
you
about?
To big. Trust me. You know how you say that you're your worst critic?
Yeah.
I'm perfectly happy in my garbagey mediocrity. I don't know what I was getting at. So the bottom line is you speak plainly with your customers. You speak plainly in regards to your work. There's no need to be anything other than a person. You know, you don't need to use big words all the time and just fully forged. You don't even use the right words. It's like when people talk to you about when they're cutting their food and they refer to their food as their – when I cut my proteins. Who talk to a chef like about their proteins? I dare you. I dare you to go – this is what happens. My partner is a chef. And people talk to him about when I cut my proteins, and he wants to just, you know, he wants to do something. But it's, you don't speak plainly.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Don't say fully forged. So this is awesome. I'm very happy for you. How can people kind of get involved with your Indiegogo thing, and how can people support you? And just real quick, what you do is very, and I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again. What you do is very important. There's a lot of people who listen to you. You give free content. And I think that as a listener, I want to support you as best I can. And I'm sure that most of the people listening to this want to support you the best we can. What's the best way?
Okay. So head to chopknives.com. The campaign is live. So there's links straight on the homepage, straight to the campaign from there. You know, I appreciate, you know, these knives may not be for everybody, you know, most of the listeners here are knife makers, you know, so, you know, right. They want to buy another person's knives, I don't know, but, you know, but if you do want to support me and, you know, and the show, there are other ways to help too. So maybe by sharing the campaign on your social media accounts, or just telling your friends about the campaign, or maybe, you know, somebody in the media who could help me get the story to sort of wider audience, you know, but, you know, any help is appreciated.
Well, how sharp are these knives?
They're very sharp knives. Do you know why they're sharp?
Well, to get your knives razor sharp and to get repeatable edges, you're going to need a Tormek. To find more, go to Tormek.com. Tormek. Keep your shit sharp.
Perfect.
Not perfect anymore. I fucked it up already. But
I'm on my second Tormek, and the first one didn't break. I just loved it so much that I then upgraded to the sort of the bigger, bulk, you know, beefier version.
Is that the T8?
The T8 I've got now, yeah. And I've also got the Japanese Waterstones as well. It's like the extra attachment. And man, these things are just amazing.
I'm going to go see those. I have the T8, and I actually used it to sharpen. So I sharpened a police officer's kitchen knives. And I used it, and I was pretty amazed at how well it worked. It's awesome. It's awesome. Yeah, I do have to see Stig. I go see Stig when I go down to the Blade Show, and I want to talk about those Japanese Waterstones. We gotta get involved with those.
Yeah, and the thing for me is it's that whole sort of repeatable thing, you know. Particularly now, you know, wanted to set up almost a production line, just being able to, you know, have it exactly the same bevel every time.
You get the jigs.
You get the jigs, and they work perfectly, and they're built, you know, they're built like rockets. These are rock solid things.
Rock solid.
Rock.
So we did the live read for Even Heat. We did the live read for Tormek. I didn't do so bad. That's all I wanted was to do the. I wanted to do a live read for my buddy John Arion and Cliff Dufton for their presses, but they haven't figured out a name for their company, and I was going to make one up, but I can't do it to them. But if you are now, I'm going to do my own live read for Cliff Dufton, CJ Dufton, and Sunset Forge NJ. If you're going to buy a press, get one from them. It's the best.
Lovely. Terrible. You should work on radio. Work on radio. You've got the face for radio.
I'm a huge broadcasting fan. I love radio. I love radio. And so I think we answered. Is there anything else? I didn't. You know, I had some questions from some listeners, and I don't know, some of them were. You know, they wanted to know why. One guy wanted to know how the Paris Marathon went.
It's not yet. It's in April the 7th. So yeah, I'm that guy. You know, buy a pair of trainers, say, I'm going to run a marathon. I'm that guy.
Have you been training?
I've been training. So I did this 2 years ago. I bought the trainers and said, right, I'm going to do this year's marathon. Signed up, managed to get a place. Didn't train hard enough, so didn't even attend.
That's fair.
Yeah, but I've the last 18 months I've been training hard, and yeah, the marathon's coming, so I'm ready.
I did the New York City Marathon. I used to love long distance running. I really enjoyed the kind of the meditation involved, and I was doing a lot of half marathons with my wife, and we would do a lot of half marathons. And as a native New Yorker, I really wanted to do the New York City Marathon. Hmm. It's a lot. It's a big time commitment. I trained and I got through it, and it was brutal, but it was, you know, the best experience I ever had. Now, as I ask everyone on Knife Talk podcast, who are your influences?
Oh, man. They change. You know, they change over time. So, as I said, that first video, I'm pretty sure it was a Walter Sorrells video. And then, you know, it's that whole rabbit hole. You then go back and look at all his other work and all the other videos. So that was a massive influence. Without those videos, I wouldn't have, you know, been making knives. But I've, you know, I'm very fortunate. So I've had a chance to, you know, to speak to the people who, you know, who influenced me on the show. So,
yeah,
you know,
you've had some pretty badass people on your show.
Yeah. So, I mean, like Aaron Goff, you know, I mean, what he's doing production wise now is just incredible, you know. And, you know, Toma from Florentine Knives, you know, he's basically producing, you know, a product, you know, his knives are, you know, they're beautiful. And it's an amazing product that he's offering. So, yeah, you've got Aaron Goff, you've got Toma from Florentine. Yourself, man, yourself.
Stop it. Knock it off. You don't have to say that. You're just saying that. That's too fast. Don't, please, let me alone. All right,
okay,
here's the next question
that
I always ask. Here's the next question I always ask when I'm interviewing people on Knife Talk. If you had one piece of – if your shop was lit on fire and you had to run in and grab one tool – what would it be? What's the one thing that you can't live without?
You know, a grinder, obviously, you know. But you know what's deep in my heart?
Tell me.
It's the Even Heat, man. It's the Even Heat. It's the it's the Tormek, it's the Even Heat, and it's my big batch of combat abrasive belts.
Let me tell you something about Even Heat. I wanted to give a shout out to my boys at Even Heat. Even Heat, those guys really hooked me up.
They're awesome.
Spence,
they are awesome.
And Quinn and Mike, they got me hooked up with the dongle. You know about the dongle?
Oh, I did see. Yeah, I did see your live video. Yes.
Christ. So basically, yes. If you have a tap control, and that is, if you're going to buy an Even Heat, now the Even Heat better send some stuff around. After this, they better send some stuff. If you have the tap control, which you should. If you're going to buy an oven, you should buy one with a tap control. It's an extra probably
If you're in the US, in the EU, you can't have a tap one, unfortunately.
Yeah, just go over to the Doy Doins or wherever you live. Go to Craigle if you treat your knife. So
but
if you're
no,
in
you
the
can't.
United,
you can't
what?
Have the, you can't have the tap controller in the EU. Which
why?
Is why I couldn't have one. It's something to do with regulations, you know, whether it's to do with the wiring or whatever. It's yeah, you can't have that controller, which is crazy. So I've got the Rampmaster too, which is, you know, it's perfect. It's everything I need. But yeah, I couldn't get the tap.
Well, let's talk to the Americans right now. I'll talk to American listeners. If you have the tap control, go contact Even Heat and get yourself involved with a dongle. And what the dongle is it connect? It's a awful name, but it's the way it is. It connects your tap control to Wi-Fi, and then you download an app, and then you can have all your information on your heat treatment on your phone. And the reason why I like it is because if I'm running
to
the train
station, that's not hand making a knife. That's using an app.
Well, I mean, here's what it is for me. They told me this. Spence told me this. You can't turn it on from your phone. And the reason why is because they don't want anybody burning people's houses down.
Yeah.
So what it does is like sometimes I have to run to the train station or I got to run to the hardware store. And the Wi-Fi dongle, I can check to see where I am with my heat treatment. So if I'm picking up my business partner at the train station and I already put my 440C in for 1900 degrees and I need to know where I am and I know that I look at my app and it says, all right, I'm at 1475. I know that I have a certain amount of time to get back to the shop. So for me, that was huge. So Even Heat, you did it again. Even Heat. Even Heat.
They're like a family business too, you know? It's cool. They're amazing.
Dude.
They're amazing.
I love those guys. I tell you what, Spence and his dad are awesome. His dad, Mike, had to put up with my nonsense for a week. He kept calling. The woman who answered the phone knew I was calling. Oh, yeah, he's waiting for you. They helped me. He walked me through. And then for some reason, I couldn't download the right – I didn't upgrade the thing. And he sent me what I needed. Those guys at Even Heat, if for no other reason than the customer service.
Yeah.
I mean, the kilns are awesome. I love their ovens. But the customer service is unbelievable. So Even Heat are, you know, that's the way it is. Yeah. I try not to curse anymore. My last one was – they like.
So that's what I've saved. That's what I've saved from the workshop. I've got the Tormach, the Even Heat, and the belts from Combat Abrasives.
That's it. That's really all you need, I guess. I think I'd probably have to save – I mean, I hate to say it, but – I think I'd have to pull an anvil and a hammer out.
Hmm. But doesn't your anvil now have a chip on the horn?
We're gonna internationally out my buddy. Well, yes, it's got more than just a chip. We had an
incident.
Hey, John, you didn't think this was gonna happen to Jim? Well, basically, there was a catastrophic injury to one of my horns. All right, so basically, anvil anatomy on this particular Fisher, my city anvil, is there's a. The top piece is forge welded to the bottom. So that also included the horn. So back in the day, you talk about customer service from the 1800s, they didn't properly forge weld the horn onto the top of the horn to the regular rest of the horn. So Dave Cordelia was doing some nonsense. And I had a hammer and all these knife makers and bladesmiths, and they were all knocking it about. And Dave loosened it up, and then all of a sudden, Big John Arian was striking, and he was striking something big, and that thing flew right off. But it wasn't really John's fault, but I like to think that it was. So Cliff and John are going to take care of my anvil at some point. You can't trust those. When they, remember they say they don't make them like they used to? They do make them like they used to. They're still fucking garbage. So I'm going to support you. I appreciate everything that you've done. And I want to make sure that, you know, everybody just give Craig a hand, because he gives so much content. He goes out of his way, and we need to support him because he's doing a great job. I'm with you.
That's a sign off if ever I hear of one. I'm with you.
All right.